And I'd like to welcome all of you to our class, 88 Gospels or 4. Which Gospels made the cut, which didn't, and why? Which is really a class on canon, how we know what's in the Bible. But the focus is Gospels. If we have time for questions, and we want to wander into questions about the letters or Acts or Revelation or even the Old Testament, that's fine with me, but my focus is going to be the Gospels. Just a few days ago, that is April 2014, this headline came out. And I know it because I receive a lot of emails. People send me questions. I get thousands of questions a year, Bible questions. And a fairly mature Christian, I'd say she's one who studies the scriptures every day, very focused manner, probably for at least 25 years. She says, oh, what do I do with this? Could this be real? How do I respond? How do I explain this to people? And ancient controversial papyrus, Gospel of Jesus' wife, not fake. These are not just questions that come from skeptics. These are questions that come from those of us who may have been Christians 10 or 30 or 50 years. Now, Jesus didn't have a wife. The reason he didn't have a wife is not because having a wife was wrong or that sex was dirty. And that's something that people don't appreciate. Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code, 2004, seemed to be saying that it would be scandalous if Jesus had had a wife. I just think it would be a bit tragic. He knows he's challenging the system. He's not going to live that long. You know, why leave the widow and the childless so quickly? But Jesus, from the evidence of the New Testament, has no wife. He has no girlfriend. This is the text in question. And how can I illustrate this? This text, this so-called Gospel of Jesus' wife, is about this big. See that envelope? It's about that big. It's about 14 lines. Half of them are completely illegible. But part of it says, my mother gave to me life, and then later, the disciples said to Jesus, Mary is worthy of it. Normally, Mary in these kinds of documents refers to Mary Magdalene, by the way. Jesus said to them, my wife, ... She will be able, I think it makes it harder to see, she will be able to be my disciple. So what do you do with this? And then Harvard Divinity School, which is where I got my master's degree, came out with, none of the testing has produced any evidence that the fragment is a modern fabrication or forgery. And that was just a few days ago. Is there evidence that it's a forgery? Yeah. There's actually some pretty strong evidence it's a forgery. But let's give it to them. Let's pretend it's authentic, because it allows us to appreciate something that's significant. When that headline said, it's not fake. Not fake. What does that imply to you? Yeah, that, oh, maybe the four Gospels we have in the New Testament are, I don't know, insufficient. Maybe we need more. Maybe he was married. Which again, I mean, if Jesus had decided to get married, that would have been completely fine. Nothing wrong with that. But it really misleads. And the testing of this document, and normally ancient documents are not subject to carbon testing. That's not the best way to date a manuscript. But they did. And it came out to from the mid-600s to the mid-800s AD. Now, when were the documents of the New Testament produced? Like the O-hundreds. Not the 100s, not the 200s. So this is 600s. And even if it was 400s, fine. But the average carbon date is in the 700s. But what else is from the 700s? The oldest surviving copies of the Quran. Does that mean that the Quran is true? The oldest Buddhist manuscripts that I've seen, I saw them in Japan, in Nara. they were from the 8th century also, from the 700s. So you say, oh, it's old. Ah, oh, it's really dated. It was written. It's not a fake. Even if it's not a fake, and it's from the 8th century, that doesn't mean that it's true. These are two very, very separate issues, and I think the publishers of this sensationalistic stuff are hoping that people won't notice that. Is this important? I'm kind of curious, how many of you have heard of the Da Vinci Code? How many of you have seen the film or read the book? The book, which when I read it, I couldn't put it down. That was 2004, like Life of Pi, 2004 had a lot of books that have reflected and shaped our culture. Well, in the Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown says that there were, in fact, 88 Gospels, and that's where I get my title from, that there were 88 Gospels, and when church got really political, that is, in the early 4th century, the Emperor Constantine, they selected four. But really, there are 84 others that they could have selected. Now, between you and me, even if you count all the fake Gospels, the late Gospels, it still doesn't come out to 88. But that book, which I loved, well-written, exciting, it was just full of error. Which you have to, if you want to enjoy a movie or a book, you have to kind of suspend. I mean, if you're reading a history book, that's different. But if it's for entertainment, you can't be so picky and critical or you will not have a good time. And you'll be a party pooper, a stinker, and no one else will have any fun. But you'd say, well, so that's Dan Brown, the Da Vinci Code. Why does that matter? And his idea is that there were multiple Gospels and that it's a conspiracy. Jesus was married. His descendants live today in France. It's been covered up by the Catholic Church. And originally, when the Christians came together, they watched a sexual act. Copulation was the heart of worship, the divine masculine and the divine feminine, which is an idea you find in Gnosticism, but not in Christianity. But the public don't really know what the difference is. Well, maybe that's just contained to the United States. I had an invitation right after it came out to go to Albania. Well, Albania is one of those Muslim countries, and I go to Muslim countries quite often. This is one that's in Europe. And I said, well, what do you want me to speak on? And they say, the Da Vinci Code. You've got that in Albanian? And I went online, and I realized it had been translated already into 150 languages. And so whether I'm in the Middle East, where I'll be in a couple weeks, or whether I'm in Africa, not so much in Africa, but even there, especially among the university students, Latin America, Far East, all over Europe, for sure, Canada, United States. This is a big deal, because even if they never heard of the Da Vinci Code, the kinds of ideas circulated, promoted by such writing, are in the background these days. They're very much in the background. It's contemporary. It's in the news. It's useful for apologetics, particularly with the very, they call it militant atheism. And I know because I meet a lot of these militant atheists and sometimes even debate them. If you want to have some fun, look me up on YouTube. Just something, I'm a shy person by nature, an introvert, but I've had an opportunity to debate a number of scholars. And I will confirm that these ideas are circulating, they're quite alive. And I'm just wondering what you would do if someone told you there are 88, how come there are only four in the New Testament? What would you say? Would you be knocked off guard? Or would you just have to do a little bit of study? It's important because young people ask these questions again and again. And that is vital for youth ministry. Youth leaders need training not only in biblical interpretation, but especially in Christian evidences to be able to engage culture. And if we're going to understand canon, how the scripture comes together, what does it mean to be inspired? In fact, if we're even going to have discernment about certain agendas that are not always identified, and we'll come back here a little bit later on, then our class actually is important. With a reference to the broader theme of the conference, I mean, who comes to the table with us? Who do we have communion with? Who is my brother or sister? These are boundary questions. I mean, if someone is, his canon is the Gospel of Philip and the Gospel of Mary,
and the gospel of Jesus' wife, or he's a Gnostic, he follows the Gnostic gospels, which normally reject Jesus' death and resurrection, because they think the body is dirty, the body is evil. So someone says, I'm a Gnostic Christian, and actually you will hear that. No, I don't believe in the death and resurrection of Jesus. Are you going to have communion with that person? Well, should we be gracious and open it up to everyone? Well, how open is too open? Maybe we'll come back to that in a little bit. I want to start talking about the authentic gospels, then we'll look at the later gospels. The authentic gospels, but let me just clarify my own interest. I'm not a biblical scholar, but I'm a great friend, a great fan of theology. I love it. You know, in my ministry worldwide, theological issues and issues of canon come up very frequently. I remember the first time I ever saw a biblical manuscript, I was just 20 years old. Since then, I've had the opportunity to see a lot of them in the universities of the world, in the museums of the world. In fact, the first time I saw an apocryphal gospel, I was 20. The Bible manuscript was in Sweden. The apocryphal one was in London. And I thought, wow, that's similar to the New Testament, but I don't remember that one. And at that point, I was a three-year-old Christian. I'd read the whole Bible three times by then. So I don't remember that one being in there. What's going on? And then when I ended up going to graduate school in a very liberal university, I was under a lot of pressure to accept the authenticity of these extra documents. And maybe you've experienced some of that as well. And it's been really fun. These are a lot of the manuscripts I've been able to look at, some of them up close. Where you're supervised in a climate-controlled room with white gloves, and they give you the manuscript, and you're able to open it up and read it. And the ones I look at, my Hebrew is not really strong enough for that, but for New Testament, my Latin and my Greek are fine. And that I enjoy. And that's the oldest, some of you may recognize it, that's the oldest surviving New Testament fragment in the world. It's in Manchester, in Britain. You can't pick it up. You can't hold it. But when I first time I saw it, you could. And they trusted me with it. They gave it to me, and I was holding it in my hand. I mean, this is like from 125 A.D., probably the oldest surviving. There may be some older, but that's controversial. In fact, I saw a biblical manuscript on the Isle of Patmos a few months ago. I just like these things, and I think it is fascinating. I want us to understand how the New Testament came to be. Canonization. Canon is just a rule or a measure. How did the 27 pieces of your New Testament come together? And I think if we're clear on that, then we can look at the apocryphal Gospels, and that's going to start making sense. Well, in the very first stage, there's circulation and exchange. And again, we're talking about the Gospels. The Gospels deal with Jesus' words and Jesus' life. In the earliest period, people are swapping stories. He told this to me. He did that in our presence. Things are somewhat fluid. There's an oral tradition. I don't think that people were necessarily writing Gospels in the year 31 or 32. The Gospels come later. I mean, just generally in the New Testament, the letters are earlier than the Gospels anyway. But once these documents are written, and they'll do their research, then there's a process of exchange. So people share with other people what they have found to be helpful. And you see that word apostolic? Apostolic documents, that doesn't mean that they're written by apostles, but it means that it is the teaching of the apostles, the teaching that Jesus had entrusted to his intimate followers. So let's not commit ourselves to the position that it has to be written by an apostle, because a lot of New Testament documents are anonymous. And if it wasn't written by an apostle, so what? I mean, what makes that such a big deal? I mean, if you think of the letters, it's now known that letters were dictated. Even educated people like Paul used a secretary. And these secretaries had a certain degree of freedom with what they wrote. So whether it's the exact words of an apostle or whether the apostle says, here's my outline, write it up for me, and I'll sign off if it's good, which is what maybe a CEO would do, someone who's really busy, someone he trusts writes it up. But the point is not, is it written by the apostle? It's does it represent what the apostle is trying to say? This would save so many arguments. They're collected. We find the Gospels being referred to as the memoirs of the apostles in Justin Martyr. This is a Samaritan philosopher who became a Christian. He was executed. He was martyred. I think it was in the 160s. But Justin Martyr talks about the memoirs of the apostles. You have a fellow significant also named Marcion. And Marcion says we have too many Gospels. He wanted only one, and that was the Gospel of Luke. And he edits it. He had an attitude towards the God of the Old Testament, so he kind of makes it less Jewish, takes out the Old Testament God, rewrites Luke, and adds some of Paul's letters, and that's his version. But funny, there's another guy named Tatian, and this is maybe 25 years later, and Tatian says he also thinks that there are too many Gospels. And he does a kind of harmony. He has these four Gospels, and that's kind of fun, but the truth is, it's better if we have four. It's better than one. I mean, God could have given us one, but it's only one perspective. The Holy Spirit works very often in giving us insight in the difference. It's where Luke doesn't really match up with Mark very well. Or John, Jesus says something at, wow, he only says something like that in once in Matthew and once in Luke and never again. Why is that? What's going on? That's the interesting stuff of theology. Irenaeus, 170 AD, talks about a fourfold gospel. So it's clearly becoming a collection, the Gospels. Maybe not in the first century, but early in the second century, the four are beginning to circulate together in a collection, a book form. Then you have the challenge of the Gnostics and other heretics who really kept the church on their toes. What do you believe? Because they're starting to produce their own writings, and they're starting to reject a lot of the apostolic teaching. And so the church is realizing Jesus isn't coming back anytime soon. These written sources are actually very good. What do we think about this? And so these teachers who have strange ideas actually serve a very valuable function of helping the leaders of the Church of Christ to specify what it is that they actually think. And speaking of Constantine, in the very early 300s, this is in Istanbul, Constantinople, the Bible has come together. I mean, it's the Old and the New Testament, because he orders 50 copies to be made of the Bible. One or two of them survive today. You say, well, why aren't there more of these Bibles? You know why there aren't more of the ancient scripts, ancient manuscripts? Because you have this time of Roman persecution on and off, especially in the 2nd and 3rd century, early 4th. And they would target church leaders, usually not just killing anyone, but the main guy. They would burn down buildings. They also would destroy Bibles. So you've got a combination of things wearing out, although a lot of these ancient Bibles lasted centuries. A lot of these documents were around for centuries. They didn't just disappear in a generation. And others were actively destroyed. I find that quite interesting, just this whole matter of duration, that some of them would last a couple hundred years. Now, after the New Testament documents are written, and again, we're talking about the Gospels here, church people do come together and talk about what is canon. But this is quite different from the modern. It's kind of a story or a myth. There's a vote being taken. Who wants Matthew? Raise your hand if you want Matthew in the New Testament. Okay. How about Ephesians? Boo. How about Hebrews? Okay, let's now vote on this. That's not what they were doing. It wasn't a vote, although it wasn't unlike a vote. It was more of a ratification. And I'll give you an example, just an illustration in the United States. You've got the drafting of the Constitution, but then each state adopts it. It's ratified. The states didn't create it. They ratify it. Does that make sense? Yeah. The church, they are coming together to make sure, hey, are we all on the same page or not? There's a ratification that's going on. That's quite different from production itself. And that ratification process is late. The documents, though, are early. There are a number of councils in the 4th century that discuss this, and you can learn all about this anytime you like. I don't want to get too bogged down in the details. But I do want to emphasize once more, this criterion of apostolicity, documents being apostolic, means that they reflect the teaching of Jesus and his apostles. That's what apostolicity is. You know, until probably, 8 or 10 years ago, in my teaching, I said every New Testament document is written by an apostle or someone that the apostles were leading. Now, that could be true, though I don't really know how I would prove that. I think that misses the point. The point is not even so much how many links are there between that document and Jesus. It's, does the document reflect Jesus' actual teaching? Is it really inspired by God's Holy Spirit? And so, what's happening with canon? Well, like the Old Testament, the New Testament comes together gradually. And the Old Testament comes together over a period of centuries, New Testament over a period of decades. From the late 40s to the mid-90s is a pretty good conservative guess. But it's a process. It doesn't fall out of heaven pre-written. It's a process, and that's okay, because that's how God very often does things. The documents are apostolic. They contain the message. Jesus did not fail. The message was passed on. But this practically guaranteed that later documents had no chance of being regarded as scripture. All the New Testament's written in the first century. The other Gospels, if we went along with Dan Brown, and you know, let's say they're 88, we have all these extra Gospels, they're not written in the first century. You say, what about Gospel of Thomas? We'll be there soon. But even that is not likely to be from the first century. They're latecomers to the party. Really latecomers. And so, what about this idea of making the cut? Which one, which Gospels made the cut, which didn't, and why? Well, the cut really has to do with this, the process of discussion in these different councils. But the cut wasn't an arbitrary determination of what documents we wanted the New Testament so that we could control people. Usually it's about control, so that we can have power over the people. That's not the cut. It's about authenticity. It's about correspondence with the message of Jesus. So what about the later Gospels? And I want to share about these under a few different categories. A number are curious about the Holy Family. Have you ever been tantalized by how little there is in the New Testament of Jesus' childhood? Wouldn't it be kind of fun to know? I mean, what do we know about him? His birth and he's two. You know, he comes back from Egypt. Okay, he's 12, and he's teaching the elders. And next thing you know, it's about 20 years later, and his dad's a carpenter. But even to say Jesus was a carpenter is an inference. The Bible never actually says that. We know so little about him, and we are curious, and so were the ancient Christians. And so we're in the second century now. And this is a document called the Proto-Evangelium of James, Proto-Evangelium Jacobi. And this is, a Proto-Evangelium is like a first gospel or an early gospel. But it's not a gospel in that sense, though people will call it the infancy gospel of James. In this document, we have Joseph, and if you can see the picture, he's an old man. Because now it's, attitudes about sex and celibacy are moving along in the second century. And certainly Jesus said, if you can stay single, that's good. In some ways, that's better. Paul said exactly the same. And that seems undeniable that marriage isn't for everyone and that some people can be far more effective by not marrying. But that's one thing. It's another thing to say you're unfit for leadership if you're married. Would we agree with that? That's a different matter entirely. But this attitude is that the Virgin Mary should never have been compromised. And Joseph appears here more as the guardian of Mary. He's an old man. He has children from a previous marriage. And obviously that's not a picture from the time, but it reflects it reflects this idea that he's an old man. Now, in this gospel, so-called, they're temple virgins. And it is amusing. You look at these Gospels from the second century. This is after Christianity has made a break with historic Judaism. And these Gospels will say some things that
are quite amusing.
Temple virgins serving at the temple. Temple virgins?
Vestal virgins, maybe, in Rome.
In paganism,
there's no such thing as temple virgins. But Mary is brought up to be one of those. And here it says they had temple virgins since the time of Samuel. It's amazing we don't read about that in the Old Testament. We have the parents of Mary, who are Anna, or Hannah, St. Anne, if you're Catholic, and her husband, Joachim. Okay, so you may have heard, did I say her parents? I may have said the wrong thing there. Joseph and Mary, but I'm talking about Mary's parents. No, I think I said the right thing. This gospel has the idea that Jesus was born in a cave. You ever been to Israel? Have you been to Bethlehem? And if you go to Bethlehem, there's the Church of the Nativity, and the heart of it is a cave, where they've erected a church over a cave. Now, Israel is full of caves. Could Jesus have been born in a cave? I don't know. Why not? But this idea comes from here. A lot of the ideas in popular culture come from these later Gospels. Joseph took her into a cave, and while the heavens stood still and the heavens rested, while time itself throughout nature and humanity came to a stop, there Mary gave birth to Jesus. A great light appeared in the cave as the baby was born. For a moment, he was pure light. And then, as the light faded, a child appeared. It's not quite Gnostic, where we're denying the body, but it's quite different from pregnancy and childbirth. I mean, it's like a light comes in and it's really bright, and then there's Jesus. And of course, in some of these ancient gospels, he's talking already. He's precocious. Now, I am not encouraging, I'm not discouraging you from reading these documents. And I'll say this at the conclusion. I think that could actually help your faith. Not because they're inspired, but because you'll have a good laugh and you'll appreciate the purity and the power of the real gospel, the canonical gospel. But in this one, right before she has the baby, a midwife checks her out, gives her a gynecological test to make sure she still hasn't been with someone. And even after, because we wouldn't want Mary's virginity to ever be jeopardized. Now, never mind, in the Gospels, chapter 1 of the Gospels, Matthew 1, we have Mary apparently having sex after Jesus was born. But the tradition doesn't necessarily follow the scripture. And that's why 12, you find he's got brothers and sisters, and the brothers are all named, and there you go. But this is not, unlike most of these Gospels, this is not just one oddity. This one exists in over 100 Greek manuscripts. Those are the ones that have survived. Surely it was circulating in thousands and much loved. Oh, that brings up another point. People say it's a conspiracy. You have all these Gospels and the church would have let people read them. And no, it actually looks like the church didn't mind people reading them at all. But it's a kind of Christian fiction. Think of a Christian fiction writer. Maybe you've read some of that. So what? All right, I'm going to talk about another one of the infancy Gospels now. And this is called the Infancy Gospel of Thomas. Not Gospel of Thomas, Infancy Gospel of Thomas. And in this one, it's mainly about Jesus and Joseph, and then anyone who tries to correct the baby Jesus, who's frequently compared to Dennis the Menace. He's out of control. He's an absolute terror. And there are these cartoons of little Jesus. You know, there's one of the stories where he's playing with a kid, he falls out the window, he dies, and Jesus is going to get in trouble, and so he resurrects the guy to get out of trouble. He misuses his powers. Jesus, did you push Zeno out the window? No, Joseph. Don't Joseph me. Haven't you got us into enough trouble? But I didn't do it. Ask Zeno. And he raises him from the dead. That's familiar from the Infancy Gospel of Thomas. There are lots of cartoons like that. I just picked one more. And this is the teacher. He's unteachable. He's a smart aleck. He's sassy. In fact, if the teachers offend him, he just kills them. Wow. In the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, Jesus blinds a number of people. He blinds them. Okay, Jesus, what letter is this? You're the teacher, you tell me. And he tries to whack him.
And the very next scene, all you see is the teacher's shoes left because he's been scorched. Rabbi Skute copped it worse when punishment was dealt. He got eternal fire, but Jesus just the belt. Okay.
This is the Gospel of Thomas. Joseph, poor Joseph, is an anxious and perplexed stepfather. Once again, this old guy who's being led around. We have the miracle of the clay birds. On the Sabbath, Jesus makes birds out of clay. Not supposed to work on the Sabbath to get out of trouble. He goes like that, and the birds fly away. That story is in the Quran also. If you've read the Quran, you've seen it there, because the Quran is based quite a bit on the apocryphal Gospels. What else is kind of fun? Well, I mean, eventually he resurrects most of the people he had killed later on. And then he starts to use his powers in a good way. Creates a feast from a single grain. He stretches a beam of wood. He's working in the carpenter shop with Joseph, and well, you know it, the wood is too short. Jesus says, don't worry, I got it. And he stretches the wood so it fits. So he's starting to use his powers in a good way. And by the end of this, he's actually a pretty good kid. And he ends up with a scene, 12 years old, in the temple, teaching the elders, and he's been reached. He's been shaped through patient education. Infancy Gospel of Thomas, probably late 2nd century. The manuscript it's in is from the 6th century. What do you think about that? And there are other Gospels about the Holy Family, like one called Pseudo-Matthew, where Jesus confronts a dragon. Joseph and Mary are in trouble. A dragon's coming, and Jesus, he takes control of it. I mean, the animals worship him. He's in Egypt, and the 355 idols of Egypt all fall down. They all bow down because it's Jesus there. All kinds of very interesting stuff, which I think it's fair to say constitute a move towards legend. When you get out of the first century, you see speculation, fantasy, legend. In the 2nd century, 3rd century, 4th century, basically the later you go, the more amusing it gets. And I see parallels as a student of world religions in Buddhism. I had a chance to study Buddhism for a year in my master's. The early Buddha basically is an agnostic. He doesn't even believe in God. He's a simple person. But you have these stories of his miracles that are attributed to him. And then eventually, with the Buddha, like in the Yataka tales, you have him talking as soon as he's born. Now, read the Quran, the Bible of the Muslims. You're not going to find a lot of miracles in there. But if you read the Hadith that come later, in the later centuries, a lot of miracles are attributed to Muhammad. This is something I really got into last year, studying the Hadith. I've got podcasts if you're interested. But there's this kind of invariable sequence of things getting jazzed up. And the critics of Christianity are quite right that that's what happened in Christianity. Where they'd be wrong, though, is that it was the same stuff going on in the time of the apostles. That basically Jesus failed to protect his message or the truth. That's just not right. Some of the Gospels are Gnostic Gospels. Gnosticism, the real you, the real world, is not the physical world, it's the world of spirit. The physical world includes your body and sex and family, and it's pathetic. This fits in really well with Greek philosophy. Plato says that your body is basically a prison for the real you. The real you is your soul. And the goal is to escape your body, not redeem the body. There's no resurrection of the body, not in the Christian sense. And it's quite elitist. And, sometimes amazingly elitist. One of them, I can't remember which one it was. A lot of these are dialogues between Jesus and the apostles, or Jesus and certain women, usually after the resurrection. And someone asks them a series of questions. How many people die every day? 30,000. How many people are saved each day? 3. You know, in other words, hardly anyone's making it. But what's the key? You need advanced instruction. There's a bit of a snob appeal here. Very well received by the New Age movement. It's not a surprise. Gnosticism is based on knowledge, gnosis. Salvation is liberation from the material world. One example, Pista Sophia. Jesus dies, and then he's on the earth after his resurrection for 11 years, teaching. Now, wait, what does the New Testament say? How long is he on the earth? Yeah, well, 50 days, but 40 days teaching, and then takes care of some errands, and then 10 days later, okay, it's Pentecost, right? But 11 years. there must be a lot of stuff we don't know. And that's the whole point. These Gospels will tell you what they are. And most humans never get there. They're not, they're just not enlightened. They're, I wish I had time to explain all this right now. The find of the century, the 20th century, was here in Upper Egypt in a place called Nag Hammadi. You know, Dead Sea Scrolls, 1947. Nag Hammadi, 1945. A lot of the translators of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi manuscripts were my professors when I was doing my graduate degrees. And they were very excited about this stuff and did not hold back trying to persuade us to accept this as well, to read all of these documents. What was found at Nag Hammadi, near a monastery, which itself is interesting, because it suggests that this was discarded by monks. Maybe it was their pleasure reading. But in the Nag Hammadi trove, there are 52 documents and, in fact, a number of Gospels. And so I want to share just a little bit of that with you. Pista Sophia, I mentioned, Mary asking Jesus a number of questions. Gospel of Philip, 3rd century. It was lost. It was rediscovered. Nag Hammadi. Mary Magdalene is the companion of Jesus. And Jesus loved Mary Magdalene more than all the other disciples, and he used to kiss her on the mouth. I don't think that's authentic, but can you see why that would appeal to some people today? With a liberal agenda? Jesus, he's got a girlfriend. They used to make out a lot. Gospel of Philip, Gospel of Mary. And here, Mary Magdalene, of course, is superior to the other followers, the other disciples. And Peter is really miffed. Peter does not like that. Gospel of Truth is a bit unusual because that's one that allows Jesus' death and resurrection. But generally, the Gnostics don't. No death, no resurrection, you don't need it. And their so-called Gospels usually begin, this is kind of the end. He's before he goes back to heaven, he's giving some final instructions, this special knowledge. National Geographic comes out a few years ago with the Gospel of Judas. Now, this is kind of interesting. Gospel of Judas. Judas is the good guy, not the bad guy. Judas helped Jesus be rescued from this woeful existence by betraying him. But that was a favor. And the truth is, Jesus asked him to do that for him. Communion is cannibalism. Salvation is connecting with the divine within. Jesus is a shapeshifter. He can leave his body. He can appear in all different kinds of forms. And there are other apocryphal documents that do that as well. Now, that's interesting. National Geographic. National Geographic. What are they doing? Gospel of Judas. It occurs to me this would be like a few New Testament scholars getting together and announcing, we discovered a new mountain range in Nebraska. Are you outside your competence? What is this? What is going on? A garbage dump. And garbage dumps often contain some incredible things. In Egypt, Oxyrhynchus is neglected. It's buried over for more than 1,000 years. And slowly, slowly, things are recovered that transform knowledge of the ancient world and even of Greek itself, how to read Greek. The Gospel of Thomas, for example, which seems to depend on Tatian from the late 2nd century, quotes over half the New Testament documents, which implies that Thomas is not an ancient gospel. Thomas is over here. Mark, Matthew, Luke, John are the old ones. Thomas is much later on. It has secret sayings. There's asceticism. There's celibacy. It's basically a list of 114 sayings. This is verse 1. These are the secret sayings that the living Jesus spoke and Didymus, Judas, Thomas recorded. Didymus is twin. In some of these documents, Thomas is Jesus' twin brother. Wow, I didn't know that. Saying 47. A person cannot mount two horses or bend two bows. A servant cannot serve two lords. Does it sound biblical? Yeah, maybe he said that. I don't know. Business people and merchants will not enter the realm of my father. That's interesting. There's a context there. Give Caesar what is Caesar, give God what is God's, and give me what is mine. And probably our favorite is the final one.
Simon said to them, "Let Mary leave us." This is Mary Magdalene. "Let her leave us, because women are not worthy of life." Jesus said, "Behold, I shall guide her so as to make her male, so that she may become a living spirit like you men. For every woman who makes herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven."
Yeah, they don't normally talk about that. It's in there. Gospel of Peter, late second century. Now, I'm not talking about Gnostic stuff anymore. Gospel of Peter, we have this move to legend. He comes out, you got to look at this later on, okay? But he comes out, you have the resurrection, and you see two men supporting the other one. So out of the cave, out of the grave, you've got Jesus and two others, I guess they're angels, and a cross that's following them. The head of the two reached to heaven, but the head of the one being led out by the hand, that's Jesus, goes beyond the heavens. So he's got this enormous body, the angels all the way to heaven, but he's bigger than that. And then there's this question, "Have you made proclamation to those who sleep?" This is the dead. And the answer was heard from the cross, "Yes." Now that could be translated from the crucified one, but normally it'll say that the cross is a talking cross. However you take it, it's very different. You know, in the New Testament, we don't have really much description at all of what happened when Jesus rose from the dead. But thanks to Gospel of Peter, we have quite a bit of cool stuff. So it's found in 1886. Pilate is the good guy. He is exonerated. This gospel, so-called, starts just before the crucifixion, and it ends when Jesus exits from the tomb. The resurrection account is jazzed up. The ascension is on the same day as the resurrection. No 11 years here of further teaching. The ascension is the very same day. There are Jewish gospels. There's the Gospel of the Egyptians, the Egerton Papyrus 2, which is the first one I ever saw, Oxyrhynchus Papyrus 840, a dispute between Jesus and a Pharisee. You have Apocrypha. An Apocryphon is a secret book. So you have the secret book of James, 2nd century, one mutilated or mutilated manuscript. Jesus stays 550 days after his redirection, his resurrection. I added that one later on. James and Peter get further instruction, but only James gets it. Peter doesn't get it. Can you see that there's something going on here? Something about the mainstream church, which respects Peter immensely, and these offshoot groups, heterodox groups that are they're kind of putting down Jesus's people. The secret book of John, 2nd century. It's very hard to follow, but you could try. The secret gospel of Mark, which seems to have been written in the 1950s or 1970s. I don't know. One section is a bit homoerotic. Not surprising, most scholars think it's a hoax. And we still wouldn't be done. There's the Gospel of Nicodemus from around 400 AD, maybe 500, which claims to be derived from records in the Praetorium. The Praetorium? Or the Roman, like Pontius? There's no record of anything from the Praetorium. No one has access to that. This is just made up. Just made up. The history of Joseph the Carpenter. The Gospel of Barnabas, where Jesus is not the Son of God. And if you read this, you feel like you're reading the Quran. And it seems that it was written in the 1500s. And then how about the Aquarian Gospel that was channeled to someone in the year 1908? It's channeled, encoded on a non-physical plane of existence, and Jesus visits the East, and he teaches the masters. He teaches the masters in Tibet and India, not just Tibet and India, but Pakistan. He even teaches people who have been dead a long time before, because a channeler made some mistakes. He visits cities that didn't even exist in the time of Jesus. And it doesn't agree with the other channelers and spiritual guys like Edgar Cayce. So everyone wants a gospel. What are the conclusions? And then I want to give you a couple of suggestions, and then we'll see how we do. With their legends, elitism, speculation, unbiblical doctrines, emphases, these extra books were actually never in the canon. They're latecomers to the scene. They're latecomers. They all assume the canonical gospels. They're filling in the gaps. You say, oh, well, people just like to write names and attribute it to John or James or Mary. No, that's not what the early Christians did. And you know that, 2 Thessalonians 2:2, 3:17. People were disciplined for just making stuff up and pretending it was from the apostles. That's not the way it was. And what else? I think this has implications. You can think about this for the water and the table. Salvation and brotherhood connect with the apostolic message. You can't just do whatever you want. And maybe most significant, these documents contain emphases that are just not right, distancing us from the creation, from God, from body, from sexuality, from family, many denying Jesus' death and resurrection. Without that, and without Jesus coming in the flesh, you've got nothing. You've got the Antichrist, you know, 2 John. Very elitist, legendary. Salvation is about knowledge. It's about realizing how wonderful you already are. It's not about repentance and embracing the kingdom of God. Salvation is not that. It's not become like Jesus. It's just be yourself. Discover yourself. This is a very modern-sounding agenda. And so, some practicals, be suspicious of hype. Master the basic chronology. Now, what do I mean by that? By hype, obviously, there's plenty of hype. We should all be suspicious of that. The chronology is really simple. Apostles, first century. Everything else, later. And if you can keep that in your mind, I think you'll do great. Do some study. Learn some facts about these extra gospels, so-called. Maybe learn the names of some. Learn some dates, some emphases, some quotes. I've got a lot of stuff at my website that could help you. Maybe even some things up here on the table. But this is, it's easy to study, and I think it's well worth the time. It'll strengthen your faith. Learn some good analogies. And I'll only give you one quick one here. The conspiracy theory is that these documents were removed from the Bible, but there's another kind of exclusion. It's not removal. It's more like refusal. I was being interviewed on a radio once, and I was trying to think, what kind of illustration? Okay, this was a guy who managed a basketball team, an NBA team. And I said, you know, it's just not fair because they took me off the team. I'm not playing for the Magic. Well, am I excluded from the Magic? Absolutely. Was I ever on the team? No. These books were never in the Bible. So it's one thing if they were in, and then there's politics, and they get excluded. It's another thing if they're excluded because they never had a chance. They contradict what we find there. Discern what's behind this agenda. What's driving this? And I think there are many possibilities, from American individualism just to a rejection of authority and love of pleasure, as in 2 Peter and Jude. And last, of course, think about the nature of faith. Now, I believe there's no other class in this room right now, so I'll stick around, but I don't expect you to do that. And if we have some questions that we want to take, we can do that, but I will release you at this time. But if you have questions, let's interact a bit. But I'm just over my time, so to be fair to you, let's bring the lights on up. And if you would like to stay here a little bit longer, you're certainly welcome to do that. But if you need to go, I'll be understanding. I won't have to look down on you in any way. Yes.
Except for literally.
Maybe.
Yeah. Down there.
Hey. You can ask. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm just wondering if there's a way to get a PowerPoint or something.